أَوَلَمْ يَهْدِ لِلَّذِينَ يَرِثُونَ الْأَرْضَ مِنْ بَعْدِ أَهْلِهَا أَنْ لَوْ نَشَاءُ أَصَبْنَاهُمْ بِذُنُوبِهِمْ وَنَطْبَعُ عَلَى قُلُوبِهِمْ فَهُمْ لَا يَسْمَعُونَ.
Has it not then become plain to those who have inherited the earth in the wake of the former generations that, had we so willed, we could have afflicted them for their sins? They, however, are heedless to basic facts, and so we seal their hearts, so that they hear nothing.
We could have afflicted them for their sins.
Every nation which rises in place of one that falls can perceive the misdeeds which brought about the preceding nation's fall. Were such a people to make use of their reason, to appreciate the false ideas and misdeeds which led to the undoing of those who once strutted abroad in vainglory, they would have realized that the Supreme Being who had once punished them for their misdeeds and deprived them of power and glory had not ceased to exist. Nor has that Supreme Being been deprived of the power to inflict a punishment on the people of the present times, a power with which He smote the nations of the past. Nor has God become bereft of the capacity to dislodge the wicked nations of today in the manner He did in the past.
We seal their hearts so that they hear nothing.
Those people who derive no lesson from history, who thoughtlessly pass over the ruins of the past, remaining engrossed in heedlessness, are deprived by God of the capacity to think correctly and to pay due attention to the counsel of well-wishers. Such is the God-made law of nature, that if someone closes his eyes, not even a single ray of sunlight will reach his sight. Similarly, if someone is bent upon closing his ears, none can make him hear even a word.
تِلْكَ الْقُرَى نَقُصُّ عَلَيْكَ مِنْ أَنْبَائِهَا وَلَقَدْ جَاءَتْهُمْ رُسُلُهُمْ بِالْبَيِّنَاتِ فَمَا كَانُوا لِيُؤْمِنُوا بِمَا كَذَّبُوا مِنْ قَبْلُ كَذَلِكَ يَطْبَعُ اللَّهُ عَلَى قُلُوبِ الْكَافِرِينَ.
To those earlier communities, some of whose stories we relate to you, there had indeed come messengers with clear proofs, but they would not believe what they had once rejected as false. Thus, it is that Allah seals the hearts of those who deny the truth.
Thus, it is that Allah seals the hearts of those who deny the truth.
The purpose behind the sealing of hearts mentioned in the preceding verse is also explained in the present verse. It is clear from the two verses that the sealing of hearts means that man's capacity to hear and understand the truth is seriously impaired because of the operation of natural, psychological laws. Because of these laws, once a person turns away from the truth because of his irrational prejudices and the dominance of lust, he becomes enmeshed in his own obstinacy and adamance. With the passage of time, this adamance is compounded to such an extent that despite all rational and empirical evidence in support of the truth, he continues to reject it.
وَمَا وَجَدْنَا لِأَكْثَرِهِمْ مِنْ عَهْدٍ وَإِنْ وَجَدْنَا أَكْثَرَهُمْ لَفَاسِقِينَ.
We did not find most of them true to their covenants. Indeed, we found most of them to be transgressors.
We found most of them to be transgressors.
The statement that we did not find most of them true to their covenants signifies the general propensity of people not to honor their commitments. They are neither faithful to the primordial covenant which they made with God, see Al-Araf 7:172, which is binding on every mortal as God's servant and creature, nor faithful to the collective covenant which is binding on every human being as a member of the human fraternity. Nor are men generally faithful to the commitments which they make to God in hours of distress or in moments when their moral instincts are awake and astir. Violation of any of these covenants has been termed fisk, transgression.
ثُمَّ بَعَثْنَا مِنْ بَعْدِهِمْ مُوسَى بِآيَاتِنَا إِلَى فِرْعَوْنَ وَمَلَئِهِ فَظَلَمُوا بِهَا فانظر كيف كان عاقبة المفسدين.
After those, we sent forth Moses, peace be upon him, with our signs to Pharaoh and his nobles. But they dealt with our signs unjustly. Observe then what happened to the mischief makers. After those, we sent forth Moses, peace be upon him, with our signs to Pharaoh and his nobles. The stories narrated in the Quran bring home unmistakably the point that people who reject God's message are not spared. Rather, they are destroyed. In narrating at length the story of Moses, peace be upon him, Pharaoh, and the Israelites, the Quran provides some important lessons for the unbelieving Quraysh, the Jews, and also the believers. The Quraysh are advised that the apparently large differences in the numerical strength of the forces of truth and falsehood in the early phase of the Islamic movement should not lead them to entertain any kind of illusion. History provides ample testimony that the message of the truth has always had a very humble beginning. That its proponent, initially, is in the hopelessly small minority of one, in fact, one in the whole world. He then proceeds, despite his resourcelessness, to challenge the hegemony of falsehood, to declare war against it, despite the fact that falsehood is backed by powerful states and empires. And ultimately, the truth triumphs. The Quraysh are also reminded that all conspiracies hatched against the prophets and all the means employed to suppress the message of truth are ultimately foiled. They are further told that God grants long terms of respite to the evil-doing nations so that they might mend their ways and reform themselves. But when they persistently disregard all warnings and learn no lesson from instructive events, he smites them with an exemplary punishment. Some further lessons are meant to be conveyed to those who believed in the Prophet, peace be upon him. First, that they should not feel disheartened by the paucity of resources, nor be overawed by the impressive numerical strength, pomp, and grandeur of their enemies. Nor should they lose heart if they find that God's help does not come at the expected hour. Second, that those who follow in the footsteps of the Jews are bound, ultimately, to be seized by the same curse which afflicted the Jews. As for the Israelites, they are warned against the evil effects of clinging to falsehood. Illustrations of this were provided by important events in their own history. They are also asked to purge the message of the earlier prophets of all accretions and distortions and to restore it to its original purity. But they dealt with our signs unjustly. They dealt with our signs unjustly refers to their rejection of God's signs and to the fact that they dismissed them as sheer sorcery. If a person scoffs at a beautiful couplet and dubs it as an amateurish rhyming, this amounts to committing an offense against poetry itself. Likewise, to brand those extraordinary acts of God as sorcery and magic, even though magicians declared that those acts were beyond their ability, constitutes a serious offense, not only against God's signs, but also against common sense and truth.
وقال موسى يا فرعون إني رسول من رب العالمين.
And Moses, peace be upon him, said, O Pharaoh, I am a messenger from the Lord of the universe. And Moses, peace be upon him, said, O Pharaoh.
Pharaoh literally means the offspring of the sun god. The ancient Egyptians called the sun Ra, worshipped it as their supreme deity, and Pharaoh, Ra's physical manifestation and representative, was named after it. It was for this reason that all Egyptian rulers claimed their authority on the basis of their association with Ra, and every ruler who mounted the Egyptian throne called himself Pharaoh, trying thereby to assure his people that he was their supreme deity. It may be noted that the Quranic narrative regarding Moses, peace be upon him, refers to two pharaohs. The first of those was one during whose reign Moses, peace be upon him, was born and in whose palace he was brought up. The second pharaoh to whom reference is made is the one whom Moses invited to Islam and who was asked to liberate the Israelites. It is this latter pharaoh who was finally drowned. Modern scholarship is inclined to view that the first pharaoh was Ramses II, who ruled over Egypt from 1292 BC to 1225 BC, while the second pharaoh was Minpeta, his son, who had become a co-sharer in his father's authority during the latter's lifetime, and who, after his death, became the fully fledged ruler of Egypt. This, however, is not fully established since Moses, peace be upon him, according to the Egyptian calendar, died in 1272 BC. In any case, these are merely historical conjectures. It is quite difficult to establish a clear chronological framework owing to discrepancies in the Egyptian, Israeli, and Christian calendars.
حقيق على ألا أقول على الله إلا الحق قد جئتكم ببينة من ربكم فأرسل معي بني إسرائيل.
And it behoves me to say nothing about Allah except what is true. I have come to you with a clear sign of having been sent from your Lord. So let the children of Israel go with me.
So let the children of Israel go with me.
Moses, peace be upon him, was sent to Pharaoh to invite him to two things. First, to surrender himself to God, for instance, Islam. And second, to release the Israelites, who were already Muslims, from his oppressive bondage. The Quran refers occasionally to both these objectives and occasionally confines itself to mentioning either of the two.
قَالَ إِن كُنْتَ جِئْتَ بِآيَةٍ فَأْتِ بِهَا إِن كُنْتَ مِنَ الصَّادِقِينَ.
Pharaoh said, "If you have brought a sign, then bring it forth if you are truthful."
فَأَلْقَى عَصَاهُ فَإِذَا هِيَ ثُعْبَانٌ مُّبِينٌ.
Thereupon, Moses, peace be upon him, threw his rod, and suddenly it was a veritable serpent.
وَنَزَعَ يَدَهُ فَإِذَا هِيَ بَيْضَاءُ لِلنَّاظِرِينَ.
Then he drew out his hand, and it appeared luminous to all beholders. And it appeared luminous to all beholders.
Moses, peace be upon him, was granted these two miraculous signs in order to provide testimony to his being a messenger of God, the creator and sovereign of the universe. As we have mentioned earlier, whenever the prophets introduced themselves as God's message bearers, people asked them to produce some miraculous sign, to perform something supernatural. In response to those demands, the prophets produce what the Quran terms as signs and which are called miracles by theologians. Those who tend to play down the supernatural character of such signs or miracles, and who try to explain them in terms of natural laws and causation, in fact attempt to build a midway house between believing and disbelieving in the statements of the Quran. Such an approach can hardly be considered reasonable. What it does demonstrate, however, is how such people can be pulled in two opposite directions. On the one hand, they are not inclined to believe in a book which abounds in narrations of an ancestral religion. They are not inclined to reject the book which carries supernatural narrations. With regard to miracles, there are two basic questions that people should ask themselves. Did God, after creating the universe and establishing a system of natural causations therein, suspend himself such that it is no longer possible for him to interfere in the workings of the universe? Or does he still hold the reins to his realm in his own hands, so that his command is enforced every moment, and he does retain the power to alter the shape of things and the normal cause of events, either partially or fully, as and when he wills? It's impossible for those who respond in the affirmative to the first question to accept the idea of miracles. For clearly, miracles do not fit in with their concept of God and the universe. Honesty demands that instead of indulging in far-fetched explanations of Quranic statements on miracles, such people should clearly declare that they do not believe in the Quran. For quite obviously, the Quran is explicit, even quite emphatic in affirming the former concept of God. As for those who, being convinced by Quranic arguments, respond in the affirmative to the second question regarding God and the universe, for them there is no difficulty in accepting miracles. Let us take the instance mentioned in verse 107, namely that the rod of Moses turned into a serpent. Now there are those who believe that serpents can come into being only through one process, the known biological process. Such people are bound to reject the statement that Moses' rod, peace be upon him, changed into a serpent and later reverted to its original shape. On the contrary, if you are fully convinced that it is God's command alone which causes life to arise from lifeless matter, and that God has full power to confer whichever kind of life He wills, the transformation of the rod into a serpent and its subsequent reversion to its original state is no stranger than the transformation of any other lifeless matter into a living entity. The fact that the latter happens virtually every day, whereas the former took place only a few times in history, is not enough to declare the first as incredibly strange and the second as natural.